We're actually going to begin this week with events that occurred 10 years ago, last Father's Day.
A Father's Day outing has ended in tragedy with the drowning deaths of three children in the Victorian country town of Winchelsea. The boys were travelling with their father when their car veered off the road and plunged into a dam.
Unfortunately, he made efforts to get all three children out of the car and he was unable to.
The defence argues that Farquharson had a coughing fit that caused him to lose consciousness and drive his car into the dam with the boys in it.
But police were convinced it was a deliberate, hateful act. Their reconstructions backing their belief he'd driven off the road, veering around a tree to reach the dam.
There were emotional scenes outside the Victorian Supreme Court after a jury found Robert Farquharson guilty of triple murder.
"You had a burning resentment that you were financing your estranged wife's new life," he said. "She had the better house, the better car, the children, and now she has a new relationship."
Rob was never likely to receive a fair trial because any potential jury has been deeply influenced by emotive and selective reporting from the media. Despite the fact that it is hard to accept, this was an accident.
Well, it's turned out not to be. Robert Farquharson was found guilty of murdering his three sons. He appealed, his conviction was overturned, and he was retried. He was found guilty again. Farquharson was unsuccessful in his bid to appeal to the High Court. The whole process took the best part of a decade, and the writer Helen Garner became a kind of court reporter to cover it all. But why this case?
The thing is that when you get interested in a case like this, especially if it's one that goes on for years, your attention is sharpened to similar cases, and it's not uncommon a case where a parent kills a child, particularly a father or a stepfather. They're not that rare. In fact, it's quite shocking how many of them crop up again and again all over the world. So it's not the first case I've written about of somebody murdering a child. The first one I wrote about was Daniel Valerio back in the 90s. But that was just a couple of weeks' work. But this one went on for what seemed like an eternity. And I often did wish that I had never heard of it.
Yes, that was where I was going to go next. I mean, it isn't your first time of following a case and writing a book about it. Did you this time consciously do things differently in a journalistic sense?
Yes, I was one major thing I did, which was I didn't do it. The book is not based on interviews, like, for example, Joe Cinque's Consolation, which contains a lot of interview material. As usual, after the first Farquharson trial, my first thought, in a sort of journalistic way, was, okay, now I start interviewing people. But I approached both sides of the family, and neither side wanted to be interviewed. And my first response was, oh, hell, well, I suppose I can't really go on without interviews. And then it suddenly struck me that if I didn't do interviews, if I backed off and detached myself from the story, I might have a stronger chance of getting a handle on it in some useful way. So that's when I realised that the way to do it was to concentrate on the court hearings and make those the central drama, as it were.
Yeah, and as a former reporter who's spent a lot of time in courts, it's really interesting to me the way you've taken these things that mostly nobody ever touches upon and made them part of the main event. And one of the things is how you can hear essentially two completely different takes on an incident, from the two different sides, as it were. And the first one sounds plausible and convincing, and then the second one sounds plausible and convincing as well.
Yes. I suppose that's the sort of gist of this book, really. And I'm aware that as I sat through those trials and sat with the story year after year waiting for the next hearing, because the hearings, as they developed, were separated by long periods of time, like a year, I found my sympathies swinging from side to side as it went on, and that was part of the awfulness of trying to stick with the story over such a long time.
Did you try and develop a system to process so much information? There's lots of complexity, actually. It sounds like a simple story at its heart, but in fact it became a very complicated one. Did you try and find a way of keeping on top of that?
Well, I'm actually not one of the world's great planners. I tend to sort of rush higgledy-piggledy into a story, then find when once I've passed the point of no return, then I start trying to find myself some structures. I worried because there were two trials. I mean, he was found guilty in the first trial, and because of some errors that the judge made in his charge to the jury, he got a second trial. But there was a lot of technical evidence in there, and it was the evidence of the physics of how the car actually got into the dam, and that was very a vexed matter. And I realised that, you know, I thought I'd boiled it down in the first trial, my account of the first trial, so that people could get a handle on it and not sort of die of boredom. But then when, of course, the same evidence came up again in the second trial, and I was just in despair thinking, how on earth am I going to write it in such a way that people will remember what they need to know from the first version of it, but see how it sort of subtly shifted in the second. And of course, in the second trial, I came to the point where I thought, the physics of the police measurements and calculations of arcs and flat arcs and curved arcs and things like that was almost incomprehensible to the layperson.
We should just say this is how the car got from the road into the dam, which wasn't immediately adjacent to the road. It's a bit of a distance.
No, on contrary, it's very close to the road.
But the path was how many metres?
70, I think. Maybe less, I can't remember, but... You know, I've been down that road. It's a flat volcanic country. You drive along and suddenly there's this overpass, a man-made overpass, and you approach it. You go up the overpass, and which has got a slight curve to it, and you go down the other side and suddenly, boom, there's this dam on the right. And it's very close to the road. I was shocked when I drove down the first time. But see, he was driving in that direction. In order to get into the dam, I first thought he must have taken a left, you know, just gone left off the road. But he'd have to cut right across the road, across the oncoming lane, and through a fence, across a paddock, and into this very, very deep dam, which was actually not a farm dam with sloping sides, but a pit left over from where the road makers had dug it out to make the overpass.
7 metres deep.
Yes.
Were you at all struck by the difference between what you were doing and what the daily reporters were doing, who faced these constraints of at least a daily deadline, and I imagine with the radio journalists more than that. And that kind of constriction, it actually means that your purpose is very clear.
Yes, you're under terrific time pressure. And because I didn't even have a contract at this point when I was sitting there in the court. I hadn't signed a contract, I hadn't taken any money, I didn't have a deadline. And I was at liberty to... basically sort of wallow in the story as it developed. This was, in one sense, a great luxury. In another sense, it was like being on a leg rope for 8 years or 7 years, however long it took. And the journalists, I'm sure, didn't find the story any less horrible and painful as I did, but they had to work faster, they had to think faster, and they had to make judgments faster or sort of make judgments that made it possible for them to actually say something.
In fact, as a former radio reporter in big court cases, you're looking for that thing that you can say next each time.
Yep.
So the next hour, you've got to find something different or new or recap what's just happened. There's always a demand.
I noticed that there would be certain points in the evidence where suddenly a couple of journalists would jump up and run out of the court. And I'd say, that's the point they're going to make with their report. Whereas I'd just quietly write it down and go home and have to sort of torture myself about it at 2 a.m. for 7 years.
You are struck, actually, and you write about this briefly, fairly early on by the kind of the professional hardness of the reporters covering the case.
Yes, and I don't see how people could survive without that carapace of toughness. I was speaking at the Sydney Writers' Festival the other day, and a young woman got up and said that she was a court reporter, and she said, "Have you got any tips about how to sort of bear this work?" She said, I said, "Well, what do you do to bear it?" And she said, "I drink. I go on these benders." And I really felt for her.
It gets me to something else, or a couple of things, actually. Do you think, or how could, trials be covered better? How could we, as citizens, understand this better because of what the journalists tell us?
People have done studies about the sort of person in the street and their attitude towards criminals, particularly murderers, and you know, how you often read in the tabloid press that they're screaming for longer sentences and screaming for, you know, in a muffled way for the return of the death penalty. But when people are given access to more detail about how a case was run, or the crime itself, or the person who committed the crime, if they're given access to an enormous amount more detail than you get from reading the papers or watching the news on TV, they tend to take a much more merciful line.
Well, maybe we should let cameras into courtrooms in the way that they do in many courtrooms in America.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I worry about how people sort of play up to cameras.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was struck by what you were talking about before, which is that if people go to trials, they tend to find it a more complex thing. And what you've done in the book is you've illustrated that the barristers, it's their job to take a set of human decisions with all the context and make it into something stark and simple.
Yes, really, it's a contest between two stories, I suppose.
Yes.
And some people are better at telling stories than others, and some sets of events lend themselves to simple stories more than others. See, in the Farquharson trial, he really only had one defence, which was that he said he'd had a coughing fit and blacked out at the wheel. And that's why there had to be so much evidence about how the car left the road, to see if, you know, the sort of tracks it left and the arc that it took stack up with the idea that the driver was unconscious.
Helen, we have to wrap this up, but one thing I am interested in knowing is, would you do this again?
Oh, I don't know. Look, I'm getting kind of old. You know, that in a way equips me quite well to do this sort of work, because I've actually been around long enough to know a bit about what human beings are like, and to stack up what I'm seeing in front of me with my own experiences or my own knowledge of the world. But, gee, it's grueling. It's hard, hard work. There's an enormous degree of anguish that goes along with writing about these things, and I just don't even know if I could tackle that again.
I'm glad she did it. Helen Garner is the author of This House of Grief. You'll find details on our website at abc.net.au/rn. I'm Richard Adie. You're with The Media Report.